Everybody, I'm very happy to start this seminar on the material constitution with Marco Goldoni and Michael Wilkinson. And we have the opportunity to discuss the last book they edited on this, and the material is called The Cambridge Handbook on the Material Constitution with Cambridge University Press. Let me just say by way of introduction that I think it's a great book. It's a very timely book as well, and for many reasons. The title could actually be The Material Constitutions, the plural, because the concept itself is so diverse, and to use one of Dworkin's very famous distinctions, there are many conceptions of the same concept of a material constitution, and some theoretical chapters, yours, Marco and Michael, for instance, Neil Walker's discussing how we can understand and approach this diversity of meanings of the idea of a material constitution. And it is evidence of how many people in law faculties, I would say, not across the world, but across Western law schools, have an interest and have some sort of involvement with the idea of material constitution. So I think the introduction is called The Return of the Material Constitution, and it's a very good title, and maybe you want to discuss that in what you will say later. Also, I have to say, and that's a very general comment on my part, but it's a fascinating book in constitutional law as such, and it's a very nice, a fascinating panoptical view on the status of constitutional law throughout modern history and throughout different jurisdictions. And you can read it that way on India, Germany, many other countries. If you don't know anything about those countries and their constitutions, it's a good entry point, whether or not you're interested in the idea of a material constitution. So I think that's great, and I just wanted to pay some kind of tribute to that. I was interested, for instance, on the chapter on Greece, for instance. I don't know a lot about the Greek constitutional law or Turkey's constitution, so really congratulations. I'm sure it was a lot of work to put that together. So what we'll do, if that's okay, that we will hear either Marco or Mike. I mean, you'll decide the priority between the two of you. But you have all the time that you want, within reason, to introduce us to what you wanted to do and your ideas in the book, and the way you see the outcome, the way you see the final product, as opposed to the purpose and the ideas you had before the book was prepared and published. So we'll do that first. We'll hear the two of you first. And after that, we'll have time for a discussion. And with us, I'm just acknowledging the presence of Professor Jean Leclerc, who is law professor at University of Montreal. And he's also visiting professor at Paris 2 Panthéon-Assas. So Jean, you're very welcome. And just to be, for the sake of completeness, Grégoire Weber was supposed to be with us today, but he can't. So you won't hear any of Grégoire today. So over to you guys. I don't know who wants to speak first. Okay, Mike.
Thanks very much, Denny. It's a pleasure to be here. Huge pleasure to be here in Paris at a time when the material constitution has some local,
absolutely,
topical interest, and to be here again after many years to renew our discussion and dialogue. And so thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity to say something about the handbook, but I'm not going to talk about the various chapters of the handbook. You've already given an idea of the span of the handbook, which reaches across from political economy to cultural belonging, political jurisprudence, as well as spanning a global reach, including chapters from India, America, and Europe, amongst others. I think there are common threads that run through the chapters, and we try to identify those in the introduction. But also what we try and do in the introduction is say something about the historical origins of the concept and its trajectory. And I'm going to focus on that today. I mentioned the topical interest, and in a sense it's a concept that has periodical revival, particularly in times of crisis, but not only. And I think what I want to do is to try and uncover some of those features of the material constitution which are aspects of a long durée history of the concept, reaching back to the late 18th century revolutions. So I'm going to offer a more specific intervention, which partly reflect my own views, also as they've developed since writing the book. So in a way, I can now approach this book as a reader of the book and have my have a debate with myself, as it were, over some of the terms in the book. And I'm going to say three things along those lines. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about the journey to the material constitution in a personal sense. And again, not so much the handbook, but the initial article, which I co-authored with Marco, published in 2018, as a sort of reconstruction of how I ended up at the material constitution. And then I'm going to say, secondly, something about those historical origins and the arc of the material constitution, which I think is necessary to make sense not only of its various conceptions, as you put it, but also to make sense of its rhetorical force, its rhetorical power. And in that context, I will argue that it's intimately connected with a revolutionary consciousness, as well as a Marxian distinction between bourgeois revolution and working class revolution. And thirdly, to illustrate that point, I'm going to take on the concept of constituent power and a recent reading of Sayers by Martin Loughlin to show us that a political jurisprudence can take us far, but not far enough, in understanding constitutional dynamics. And prompted by that engagement with Loughlin, or rather Loughlin's critique of Sayers, I want to say that the struggles of constitutional politics are properly understood as material struggles, and that the material constitution is not merely the way that the social forces contingently condense, but is also an idea associated with a particular history, and that history is the emancipation of labor, which I believe is part of the constitutional imagination that I associate with this historical reconstruction. So the first then is the I realize I've only just started to put my timer on, so I was going to see how long I've spoken for, but I see I've given myself a few free minutes because my time only starts now. So as a personal reflection, I moved from a political critique of legal formalism to an appreciation of the political economy that is directing, in a two-relational way, the various the way that rules of law are applied and enforced. In for me, the particular context of that disjunction between let's say the law in the books and the law in action was the Euro crisis. So I was studying as a scholar of EU law the Euro crisis and thinking about how that was playing out, and as a matter of constitutional politics, to speak of the material constitution in that sense had an important rhetorical function, to point out the difference between the formal legal norms and the actual constitutional dynamics. So, for example, formal constitutional norms may say relatively little about crucial political institutions. It could be the role of the prime minister, it could be the role of the cabinet, the central bank. It could be about the role of semi-public institutions such as trade unions or interest groups, or in the context of the Euro crisis, that was the which was the object of my study, the Euro group of finance ministers, to quote the formally informal group that was directing the response to the Euro crisis itself. And it was illustrative to me of the way that semi-formal negotiation had become crucial to constitutional development, particularly in the context of the Greek crisis, but also elsewhere. And we say in the original article that the constitution, as well as being formed out of political unity, institutions and social relations, contains certain political objectives. Another way of putting this is to say that the constitution is a project as well as a system, as has been put by Paul Kahn and Lachlan himself, among others. And here things get a bit more complicated, because those objectives may be explicit, but they may also be implicit. As a minimal, we might say that the objective is the maintenance of the ruling regime. But constitutional discourse also frames the way certain things are approached, as when, for example, Angela Merkel said that if the euro fails, Europe fails, or when the ECJ rubber-stamped highly dubious programs of financial rescue coupled with austerity regimes. And that final point brought me to a deeper layer of the material constitution, which we can call social relations. And this, in our reconstruction, in our model of the material constitution in the article, is, I think, the deeper layer, if we use the geological metaphor of layers of the material constitution. And this is absolutely central to the historical arc of the material constitution. So I'm going to say a little bit more about that, about this idea of social relations and how it is intimately linked to the revolutionary consciousness that emerges in the 19th century, and indeed the notion of constituent power. And I do this in order to make sense of a point that Neil Walker makes in his chapter in the handbook, that the part of the function of the material constitution is rhetorical. I would say rhetorical in quite a specific way. So let me try and explain that. This then brings me to the second point, which is the significance of modern revolution and the historical arc of the material constitution. The material constitution is a legacy of a revolutionary consciousness that is traced back to the late 18th century revolutions in France and America. In other words, its prerequisite is the concept of the political constitution that emerges out of the bourgeois revolutions themselves, the concept of political equality, of political autonomy, what is sometimes confusingly labeled the autonomy of the political realm. And I want to say that the autonomy of the political realm must be understood in a double sense, in the sense both of a secularization thesis — this is the sense in which it is often understood in the notions of the disenchantment of modernity and the rupture caused by the end of a theological mindset — but also in the sense of a rationalization thesis, whereby in the modern state there is a differentiation between the political and the economic realms. And I think the first is a fairly staple part of constitutional theory, the idea that the modern constitution depends upon a secular founding, but the second is perhaps less fully understood. This double sense of the autonomy of the political means that the modern 19th century European state is a product of disenchantment on the one hand, namely the end of a theological mindset, but re-enchantment on the other. The claim in modern liberalism that the political and the economic are differentiated or even separated. In other words, it is both a democratic and a capitalist state. And I think that, for me, that dynamic is a very useful one to simplify the way that the material constitution evolves over time. Invocation of the material constitution, then, is performed in the specific sense of debunking a myth or an illusion, that of the radical autonomy of the political in the context of a capitalist society, not merely a capitalist economy. In a capitalist society, there is no radical autonomy of the political. And yet it doesn't deny the secularization thesis that there is an autonomous political realm, but counts it as radically incomplete as a measure of real freedom. And so we pick up the story of the material constitution in the book by looking at the 19th century socialism of LaSalle and Marx, who offer in different ways the material constitution as a subversive rhetorical device against the existing social order in the service of a radical reformist or revolutionary aim, namely the overthrow of the bourgeois order of political rule and the capitalist society that it is embedded in and that it maintains. Its function, the rhetorical function of the material constitution then, is to highlight, for LaSalle, the real, in scare quotes, my scare quotes, not his, foundations of society, in the sense of the way political society is reproduced materially in the order of capitalist social relations, and the contradictions and struggles contained in them, both to critique the existing arrangement of power and to point out how it might, in a future socialist society, be transcended. Now, there's an important caveat here, which is that as a historical matter, this rhetorical arc and the process of political struggle that accompanies it is not immediate. The feudal order does not immediately disappear. And so we have a continuation of struggles in both political and material senses. And these are often intertwined, which makes things very complicated. Think, for example, of the notion of revolution from above that continues into the late 19th century and Gramsci's evaluation of Italian capitalism and how the capitalist system is changed in order to centralize a state from above and without the revolutionary struggle from below. Or think about the way that theological presuppositions as well as feudal social relations continue into the modern era. So it's not an overnight change. But the material reproduction of society is necessary for understanding the material constitution and yet not sufficient. For the material constitution to have some purchase, some critical purchase, it must presuppose a gap between the formal and the material. This is where LaSalle goes wrong by collapsing the two into one unit. Therefore, it is in one specific sense a modern idea that could not have taken hold without the bourgeois revolution, but which nevertheless requires a sense of a transcendence of that regime in order to make sense of its rhetorical force. And this brings me into the third part of what I would like to say, which is to try and illustrate that point a bit more concretely using the work of Sayers and his understanding of the pouvoir constituant, or the original constituent power, which in his reading becomes, in a sense, collapsed into a derivative constitutional power, constituent power. As Martin Lochman recently points out, for Sayers, the third estate was both a political and a material subject. Materially, it was the productive class, the class that produced and reproduced the nation. But politically, it was the bourgeoisie that was to represent the entire nation. We can already see in that disjunction the difference between the political and the material senses of constitutional power. Its materiality, its dynamic, is further undercut by the disappearance of the original constituent power. In Sayers's model, it becomes subsumed into a formal constitution-amending power. As Lochman puts it, to quote, "The concept of constituent power Sayers invokes is designed to justify the transfer of political power from the aristocracy to the bourgeoisie, and to make sure it stays there." Lochman wants to rescue the dynamic interplay between rulers and ruled, represented by the notion of constituent power, and he does so by synthesizing it with the notion of popular sovereignty. Popular sovereignty gives it a more fluid character. Constituent power can then capture a dialectic, in Lochman's view, between the constitution of the state, the political pact, and the activity of governing. And Loughlin's aim in rescuing this conception from a legal notion of constitutionalism, which Loughlin describes as the normative fallacy, is quite instructive. However, Loughlin then rejects the concept of the material constitution as collapsing the dialectic into sheer fact, which he calls on the other side the material fallacy. This is from his chapter on constituent power in the Cambridge Handbook of Constitutional Theory, which is forthcoming or is already out?
No, it is forthcoming.
Forthcoming.
I think 2024.
I hate to think I'm giving Loughlin all this free publicity, but it turns out that I am. However, and this is where I want to push back against Loughlin, even though I think he does a valuable service in rescuing the notion of constituent power from a sheer normativism. And there are two things I want to say here. One is that if we look at the concrete examples, in fact the very same ones adopted by Loughlin's political jurisprudence, we can see that they are material struggles through and through, whether we're talking about the revolutionary struggles of the late 18th and 19th century, or whether we're talking about the Weimar interlude, which plays a particularly significant role for Loughlin, which I'll come to in a moment, because of the significance of Carl Schmitt in rescuing a certain form of material constitution. So the political jurisprudence cannot make sense without material struggle. And secondly, I want to say against Loughlin's reading that the material constitution is not sheer fact. It is, on the contrary, a constitutional imaginary. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that. It's one which needs a concrete analysis of its specificities, as well as an awareness of its generality in a capitalist state, but one which also has an important ideational role. So first, the materiality of political jurisprudence. And I want here to use the example of Weimar, and Loughlin is not the only theorist to raise the debates in Weimar to a level of a high significance. But in Loughlin's reconstruction of the Heller-Schmitt-Kelsen debate, we see only Heller and Schmitt's anti-formalism and not the material nature of their interventions. And in order to make sense of those interventions, we have to think, for example, of the significance in Weimar of the labor constitution, which emerged not only in early debates among Weimar labor lawyers, but was part of the constitutional text itself, as well as the recent excavation of Schmitt's own attachment to economic liberalism. Schmitt, by most authors, is presented as a thoroughly anti-liberal thinker. But if we look at his concrete positions in the Weimar debates, his concern was to defend the bourgeois order of private property. Of course, he was unsure of the best means to achieve this, hence his highly opportunistic twists and turns throughout the 20s and 30s. Heller, too, thought that the struggle for social equality was essential to the condition of the democratic state. And without using those terms, Heller's constitutional theory can be seen as trying to resolve the dialectic of capitalism and democracy, formal and material equality that I mentioned earlier. But I also want to say that the omission in Loughlin's account of the substance of these political debates is not incidental to his political jurisprudence, but is characteristic of the broader abstraction. And here I want to quote again from the Cambridge Handbook article, his chapter on constituent power. I quote, "We appreciate the role of constituent power / right only once we recognize first that the political is a domain of indeterminacy. Secondly, that since the constitution of the state expresses a way of political being, a gulf will always exist between the norm," in parenthesis, the written constitution, and the actuality, in parenthesis, the way of being, and thirdly, that this gulf is filled by the activity of governing. Now, by way of my own parenthesis, Loughlin weakens the notion of constituent power by conflating it with constituent right, which, contrary to his own protestations, I think put him firmly in what I would say is a rather liberal camp. However, what I want to ask is why, and how the political remains a domain of sheer indeterminacy. How does the activity of governing fill the gulf between norm and fact in such conditions, if they are so indeterminate? How does it sustain a way of being? What is political governing for? All of these questions, I think, are abstracted from in the account of the political jurist. And I think I'm going to say now in the final part why that's problematic. In the realm of the methodology of constitutional debate, I want to say that the material constitution does two things. First, it insists on an analysis of constitutional dynamics at a lesser degree of abstraction, or to put differently, in a more concrete register. Since constitutional law is constituted by and in turn reconstitutes material social relations as well as political relations. If we take Weimar itself and the interwar period in general, we can see that evidently that the way in which constitutional law reflects various social movements and in turn reconstitutes them in relation to labour law, private property relations, the social state, we cannot understand the dynamics of constitutional change without having that in view. I think we can also, at a lower degree of abstraction, distinguish among constitutional types, what we might call varieties of constitution, varieties of constitutionalism, even within the broad framework of the material constitution itself, and some of them are mapped in the handbook, and maybe Marco will say a little bit more about that later. But to return to the rhetorical role of the material constitution, in Walker's chapter, he says it expresses a certain scepticism towards the prevailing liberal political order. But I want to suggest that it does so in a way which directs against a straightforward project of counter-hegemony in a linguistic or cultural register. And if we think, for example, about the work of Chantal Mouffe or Claude Lefort, where language is presented as a dominant political register, then I think what the material constitution does is to warn against the sense that we can substitute material political struggle for the struggle over discourse. But in a way, the more challenging alternative rhetorical role is that played by conservative thinkers in the cultural register. We might say even reactionary thinkers, if we take the examples of Schmitt, and also in the book is a chapter on Mortati. These readings, highly conservative readings of the material constitution, can be understood as appealing to a previous order that is threatened by modern capitalism's propensity to melt into thin air that which was previously solid. Perhaps even to appeal to a return to a pre-capitalist order or aspects of such in relation to the family, national culture, national identity. These, what we might call right materialists, are in a sense more difficult to contend with as a matter of rhetorical gambit. So part of the book is, and I think this is the main part of the book, is to offer a model of understanding. And in this sense, it's, I think, is a positive feature of the book and of the idea of the material constitution, that it takes in such a variety of different political perspectives. But I would want to conclude by suggesting, and here I end more ambiguously, perhaps just suggestively, that the material constitution shows these as essentially attempts, these right materialist moves, as attempts to conserve existing relations of hierarchy, domination, class differentiation, whether domestically or in the guise of imperial colonial relations. The means, in other words, were very different from the dominant liberal paradigm, but the ends perhaps not radically so in comparison. And on that note, I will hand over to Marco. Thanks very much.
Good. Okay, so I'm going to pick up from where Mike left now, and I'm going to insist a bit more on the material constitution as fundamentally a tool for understanding, especially a tool for understanding, and in this case I would say understanding in particular constitutional reality. And then I will just mention a few of the challenges that are actually contained in the handbook. The handbook is so liberal in its spirit that contains actually a few critical chapters, one actually authored by Professor Barranger, on whether it still makes sense to talk about the material constitution. Do we still have material constitutions nowadays? So I'm going to basically broach these two legs of my intervention. First things first, the material constitution as an intervention for as a concept, sorry, for understanding constitutional reality. This basically is as both epistemic value, but also, as Mike was mentioning before, type of a normative. It's normatively loaded, you know, as a type of analysis. It is normatively loaded because it entails that there are certain social patterns that need to be arranged and need to be organized, and organization here is a key word in my view, in order to obtain what can be called a constitutional order. Now, I don't want to load the term constitutional with too much normative meanings here. I don't think there is something specifically Western about the material constitution, although it is clearly a concept whose origins are Europeans, and whose origins are basically within the rise and the development of European modern capitalism. But in the way states and empires have spread across the globe, and in the way the political economy, actually, modern capitalism has evolved into something that has basically reached almost all corners of the globe, I think there's nothing specifically Western about the validity of the concept of the material constitution in order to grasp constitutional reality. Which explains why the majority of chapters of the third part, which is the part which contains concrete analysis and applications of the material constitutions, are mostly devoted to non-European countries. You know? So look at the differences. The first part, which is basically a reconstruction of the concept in constitutional thought and the history of constitutional thought, is mostly, honestly, about European thinkers and European experiences, you know, Germany, Italy, France, the UK with Lasky, Greece. But the third part is basically fundamentally, apart from a chapter on the European Union, it's all about fundamentally non-European countries. So this is to show that, in my view, in order to answer to the second question, whether it still makes sense to talk about the material constitution today, I think it does make sense. And I will explain myself later about this with more concrete examples. But in terms of understanding of the constitutional reality, there is something specific about the contribution made by the material constitution. And I'm here fundamentally just repeating what Mike was saying before. The material constitution cannot be simply an understanding of, you know, organizational society based in, you know, the usual options that we have as constitutional theorists. It is neither a rule of recognition, because it doesn't operate according to the logic of the rule of recognition. It is clearly a case, a political case, to understand the material constitution as something that is not conventional. It cannot be conventional by definition. No, you cannot converge upon something unless you first somehow find a common interest in order to converge on certain type of objectives, which is exactly not the Hartian project of trying to ground, no? Fundamentally, the British Constitution is to a conventionalist understanding. The reasons and the interest why political, economic, and social actors converge on certain fundamental objectives cannot be a convention. It has to be clear why we are doing this. I mean, it might be not explicit, as we were saying before, but it has to be clear. And we might diverge in forming a coalition in order to support the material constitution for the pursuing of certain interest, but definitely there has to be some common interest that certain sectors of society are pursuing. Otherwise, this doesn't work. So it, at one level, it really does not operate as a rule of recognition in order to understand what is the reality of a constitutional order. So as such, I see it more, you know, as a reconstruction of, I would say, a material ground that is fundamentally necessary, common to modern forms of political organization, states and empires, and maybe, if you follow Bo, federations as well, no, as an alternative political form. But what is basically common, no, to all these forms of constitutional organization is that they all try to achieve a certain level of political unity in a way that is typically modern, and it is in a way that, in my view, remains relevant in the development of current contemporary constitutional orders. And it does so by fundamentally establishing what we call an internal relation with societal organization, and in particular, specifically, and this is, in my view, our specific contribution to this conception of the material constitution, by fundamentally tying the constitutional form of organization to societal processes of production, and I would say actually, and reproduction. So in this sense, it is definitely alternative to a liberal approach to constitutional theory and constitutional understanding. No? The classic liberal approach, and allow me a bit of simplification for the sake of time, but the classic liberal approach sees law and the constitutional system as something that is fundamentally not imposed, but I would say simply put upon an already constituted civil society, most of the time in order to protect certain rights or certain interests of that already constituted civil society. The point here is that the material constitution is fundamentally the unity, or the strive to achieve political unity, internal to that society. It's not something that is external, and as an external object is then imposed upon society. That, in my view, changes the analysis dramatically in terms of, you know, what you can get out of it, and it changes in very substantive terms. So it makes it then the material constitution something that is fundamentally teleological, in my view. That is, there might be material constitutions, but that's because there are specific objects for each type of material constitution. No? More concrete and specific objects around which, no, certain social and political forces do gather around. And they are fundamentally, in my view, these objectives are fundamentally the glue, no, that hold together the assemblage that might become the material constitution. Under this aspect, you see that there is clearly, as Mike was saying, there are clearly cycles where we go back to discuss the material constitution, especially when there is a sudden gap or a slack, no, that is unsustainable between the societal organization of relations of production and its constitutional form. Now, there are moments when this doesn't hold together anymore, or the slack become extremely evident, and therefore you can clearly see there that there are struggles in order to change some of the fundamental political objectives. I mean, it's really trivial to remind that these are usually either periods of war or periods of deep, extreme economic financial crisis. These are the two main vectors of actually constitutional change to core, right? So the emergence of the bourgeoisie as an hegemonic political and social class clearly signals then that there should be also processes, no, in order to change the constitutional form and unity of the relevant society. But at the same time, of course, the rise or the contradictions manifested in that type of liberal arrangement, in particular in its political economy, might give rise later on to a Fordist reorganization of relations of production and reproduction, whose cascade effects are such that on the rest of society, that basically they impose a partial reorganization of society. So not only labor relations in that case, but of course also family relations. Different role of the state, so rise of the administrative state through the creation of the welfare state, penetration therefore of the state in some of the fundamental nodes of societal organization and so forth and so on. So these are momentous changes which of course have a deep impact on societal organization, and makes it the case that although there is functional differentiation between different spheres, and I would say even more clearly between different systems, there has to be, by definition in my view, there has to be a moment of unity, and the moment of unity is the moment where the material constitution is effective and maintains its efficacy. That's the crucial difference with all the sub-societal constitutions. No? You might have sub-societal, call them constitutions if you will, I would rather call them fundamentally spheres, but the key point is that in a regime of modern political economy and contemporary political economy, there has to be a moment of striving for political unity. It cannot be simple, sheer fragmentation. Which leads me to the two other points that I want to make about the contemporary relevance of the material constitution. Now, the question, in my view, still makes a lot of sense. No? I mean, why does it make sense to wish even for a return of the material constitution as a tool of constitutional analysis? I mean, does it really capture something that is going on? I mean, again, I was mentioning fragmentation before, but think about the debate on fragmentation in different legal environments. No? You might want to think that, look, there is no material constitution there. You cannot really place those certain dynamics, no, of fragmentation differentiation between supranational, national, under the same umbrella of the material constitution, and therefore it doesn't make much sense, no, to keep talking about it. It's not anymore the 19th century where he had a clear structure, no, and the material constitution was, according to the socialist, that liberal structure of the constitutional state. It's not anymore the 20th century, where probably if I have to locate a dynamic the dynamic of the material constitution would be mostly a dynamic of integration. No? It's a dynamic where the state takes on more and more social functions, no, and try to integrate more and more social classes. But then what is it, no, in the 21st century? And this is a big question in my view, and which legitimates some of the doubts that are actually present in the book. I mean, if you are a radical legal pluralist, for example, you might want to resist a notion like the material constitution, right? Because you might want to say that epistemically speaking, it doesn't really capture the type of pluralism that has emerged since, I would say, the end of the 20th century. Now, I don't have a clear answer on what is the peculiar dynamic of material constitutions nowadays. No? I tend to see, and I think by now probably a lot of people would agree again, that the state remain the main site of organization of the material constitution. It is still the main site that grants or makes possible not to try to struggle for political unity. But what is the logic of the dynamic behind it remains, in my view, a question that is worth exploring. No? Exploring in all its dramatic, no, qualities. Think about, just to make an example, at the changes of the role of political parties in the dynamic of constitutional developments all around the world, but especially in Western countries. So the political parties which were probably the main subjects of the material constitution with the 20th century, and both leftist scholars and conservative scholars, that is, from Gramsci, who is clearly maybe a thinker of the material constitution, to on the left side, to Mortati and Schmitt and Heller and less leftist thinkers, they would all agree that political parties, or the political party, was the main form of the organization of the material constitution. Why? Because it would serve, you know, as a point of synthesis between two crucial poles. One, of course, between civil society and the political system, but also it would serve fundamentally as a moment of unity between the different systems that animate society, no? The political economy, the legal system, and the political system. So the political party would basically find itself, no, as the role of maintaining the unity. I think it is quite obvious that by today, and I'm picking up just this example because it's, in my view, quite evident, political parties in at least the Western countries don't play this role anymore. They might play it formally, but that's basically just a facade. It's a complete facade. And but therefore this means that if you are, for example, analyzing, and you are writing a constitutional analysis of political parties and their constitutional role, you need absolutely to take this change into account. You cannot treat political parties as if they were the same type of institutions that they used to be in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. No? The change is dramatic. I mean, they are still institutions, but they are basically mostly like electoral cultures by now, rather than anything else. No? Now, what they have become, it's a big question, which in my view has an enormous and fascinating constitutional relevance. But this is just to show you how I would frame, no, an analysis of the change of the constitutional role of political parties through the lenses of the material constitution. No? Which leads me to the last point that I want to make here. I think, quite surprisingly maybe, because there's no mention in the handbook about this, but it would be interesting actually to tie back this debate to a growing stream of scholarship that comes back now from the US, but it is gaining traction also in Europe, which is this debate on law and the political economy. The US is born out of a reaction against law and economics, and it is probably inscribed in the tradition of first legal realism and then critical legal studies. I think there is a different tradition in Europe. Certain authors of the material constitution clearly speak to this scholarship, in my view, to the scholarship on the political economy. But I also have to say that it's quite difficult to imagine today an analysis, a constitutional analysis of both understanding of constitutional reality, conceptions of constitutional change, and up to the point of tracking real constitutional subjects and organs without engaging with the political economy of contemporary constitutionalism. I don't think this is really, if the aim is fundamentally tracking constitutional reality, I don't think this is possible, no? If one avoids an engagement of with the political economy of contemporary constitutionalism, which basically means that when we look at classic and traditional institutions of the constitutional state, we need to put them in conversation, or probably even more than in conversation, with other institutions whose governing capacities, and I'm using here governing in the Loglin sense of the word, So the governing capacity of certain institutions clearly goes well beyond the original distinction between the governed and the governed. The governors, no. What's the difference is those who are governed and those who govern, right?
Yeah.
Which is, for Loughlin, rightly so, in my view, is in modern times the original move toward the constitution of authority. But now things have become, I would say, a bit more complicated and blurred. Now think, for example, about the role of financial markets in providing political trajectories to the development of modern constitutional developments. So I will leave with this example. In certain constitutional orders, suddenly you see organs who used to be classified as administrative agencies and subject, and they are still subject to fundamentally the accountability, political and legal accountability of an administrative agency, actually rising to the level, in my view, of crucial constitutional organs, precisely because those are the organs that allow some of those institutions, I'm insisting here is the easiest example, are financial markets, to actually play a constitutional function. So central banks, certain banks, not all, I would say, certain central banks clearly seem to have undergone a constitutional transformation and have made themselves as constitutional actors. It's very difficult today to think about the ECB or the Federal Reserve as simple administrative agencies. These are constitutional organs. These organs, they govern. And they don't govern through political parties, they don't govern through political hegemony, they do govern by basically listening and even ultimately making financial markets, as if there was no possible alternative reality outside of those basically made up by the inputs, epistemic inputs of financial markets. And I will leave it here because I've already spoken for too long.